that's basically finished, and we're just writing it up. So it should be out this month, although whenever I say that, it's a recipe for disaster. I know it won't come out this month, but it, in principle, should. And it's work done in collaboration with Joe Barsi and Ben Simons, who are in Cambridge in physics, Julian Sonner, who many of you may know, in Damped, and Jerome Gauntlet at Imperial. And one thing to maybe stress is that these two people, you won't have necessarily heard of them, but that's because they're not string theorists, they're condensed matter physicists. And I mean, just sort of sociologically speaking, it's, you know, ADS-CMT, as it's become known, is it's a subject that, in principle, really should be studied because it may be useful for condensed matter physics, presumably. And there's remarkably little condensed matter physicists who are using any of these ideas. So I think it's nice to have some sort of genuine interaction. And also, I would like to stress that I know very little about condensed matter physics, or rather, very little is a total underestimate. I know almost nothing. So many of the things I'm going to say, I know nothing about. And it's, you know, I'm just repeating words that I've heard from these guys. Conversely, they know almost nothing about black holes, it turns out. So I think it's fair to say so. So, you know, hopefully we learn something through interacting like this. Right. So the plan for the talk, unless you divert me with lots of questions, which would be fine and good, but assuming that doesn't happen, I'm going to talk briefly about what quenches are, in, specifically in the context of superconductors. These are, you know, I mean, you all know that there are superconductors, and you know, you build them in the lab, and there are various different varieties of materials or and gases which exhibit sort of superconducting behavior. And these are also systems, in some sense, the trick with superconductors is not to quench them. I mean, that's the whole deal with them. I mean, the reason they took so long to produce is because many of them are unstable to raising temperature or kicking them at all. And in some sense, you know, there's a lot of interest now in understanding that dynamics. And from the context of superconductors, I am reliably informed by my condensed matter collaborators that the sort of state of the art is the work of Barankov and Levertov, and I'll tell you pretty much everything I know about it in a very short time. And then I'm going to talk briefly about ADS-CMT and superconductors, but I think many of you may be familiar with that, so I don't want to spend too long telling you things you already know. And then I'm going to talk to you about how to think about dynamics of those superconductors, and specifically a sort of quench situation that corresponds to something analogous to what people look at in BCS theory. And it's a very pretty numerical GR problem. I mean, it's not numerical GR as a serious numerical GR do it. I mean, it's a 1+1 problem. But it's very pretty, and there's lots and lots of sort of physics in it. And in particular, the phenomenology of what you see happen in the simulations can be understood in a very sort of generic way. And I guess the punchline is that, you know, that this picture that emerges from the gravity, it's easy to understand what's going on. There's some interesting phenomenology that's easy to understand. And it's precisely, or appears to be precisely the same phenomenology you see in this very, very different context of the BCS quench theory. And so the idea is not to say, yes, there's holographic superconducting materials in this person's lab, and we're going to kick them by turning on a whatever for this field in the bulk. I mean, that's fanciful at the moment. But the idea is that in a real condensed matter situation, solving the dynamics of superconductors is extremely hard, and the state of the art is, from our point of view, very disappointing. It's disappointing what you can do. Or rather, to put it another way, it's remarkable what the dynamics of this ADS-CMT is telling you. I mean, it's just things that you can't possibly calculate in field theory. Now, BCS theory is known to, we understand it. It really does describe real world materials. It's far from clear whether holographic superconductors do, but one should probably think of these studies as being like toy models of, almost like as integrable systems are to quantum field theory. Realistic quantum field theories, these might be toy models, solvable toy models of superconductors. Maybe they don't exhibit all the phenomena you want, but at least you can do calculations, whereas in these cases, you're so limited. On the one hand, you write down the Hamiltonian you want and you can't solve it. On the other hand, you write down something that looks like a toy model, but maybe vaguely plausible, and you can solve it. And what you really want is somewhere in between. So this is the sort of other end. I'm not going to do any of that unless people really want me to. Do people really want me to? So I'm assuming you all know about the very basics of ADS-EFT, so I'm not going to tell you anything more about that. But as I say, at any point, do ask questions.
Can I ask
that? Yeah.
When you go back to BCS superconductor, do we get to invoke the words strong coupling or conformal fixed point at all in the systems you're going to study? Or
yes, so I mean, I want to make it, I don't want to overstate anything, Rob. So what I'm going to say is that in condensed matter physics, people understand BCS superconductors. They understand them well. But they can't do any, dynamics is very hard in that context, realistic dynamics. Then there are other superconductors, sort of various high temperature superconductors, for example, and other condensed matter systems, other materials that appear not to be described by any simple weak coupling theories like BCS. So BCS just doesn't predict their properties. And they're thought to be, people like Subir Sachdev, for example, propose that there are many of these materials may be described by quantum critical theories, basically conformal field theories at finite temperature, or deformed in various ways. And because they're just conformal field theories, they'll generically be strongly coupled. There's no sort of weak coupling perturbation theory you're going to be able to do. And that somehow fits nicely into this idea that in ADS-EFT, you have a conformal field theory dual that is strongly coupled. But I suppose there's all that language, but I really want to step... what I definitely don't want to say is that ADS-EFT models are describing real-world materials. I mean, they may have some similar features, but I think it's just very unclear at the moment. I'm a pessimist, Rob.
You're a pessimist.
But what I would say is that, they are a toy model of strongly interacting materials that you can do, for example, dynamics with. You can ask about transport and you can solve that. Where you simply can't do the same thing even in weak coupled systems, far out of equilibrium is very hard, but in strongly coupled systems, it's impossible.
The two-dimensional Ising model is also a toy model, but you can find it in every single textbook.
Well, that's because it's solvable. Yeah, that's because it's solvable and there's some notion of universality. But, people, you can say the words that, maybe the theories that you find, the phenomena you find in ADS-EFT is somehow universal. But I just don't understand what that means. It's very difficult to know, I don't think that's really been made precise.
But is the observation going to be that the condensed
I'm being
matter
very negative,
system,
I'm sorry.
The condensed matter system shares some properties in common with your gravity system, and that's a remarkable coincidence? Or
I suppose, yes. The conclusion at the end of the day will be something like, we'd like to say, look, here's one model of a quenchless superconductor that has various simple phenomenology. Here's another model of a completely different type of superconductor. It's strongly interacting, blah, blah, blah. And it's got similar phenomenology. Maybe that phenomenology is very general and very robust. And as I'll show you later, there may be good reasons to believe that phenomenology is robust. And I don't want to really claim anything more than that in this talk, but I could re-say it in another way, that maybe there is a material out there that actually is described by that.
Right. We should make us sell it as a prediction for the Cooper rate.
Exactly. A specific Cooper rate. I mean, not just the...
That would be good. We've got a model in the back of the room.
I know. I mean, if it was... if you weren't an ADS, I'm a pedant. If you weren't an ADS CFD audience, I would be saying yes. Well, you know, this really might be the materials, you know, in the real world. And since you'll work on this stuff, I'm going to take the other point of view.
You do the calculation in a toy model, then you do it in another toy model with slightly different parameters. You obtain a different thing. Then you stick your neck out and you say, well, maybe if you do something similar to this guy in five dimensions, you get a problem. I mean, that's the universality of the model.
But that's not, I mean, universality, if you say universality to a convinced matter theorist, it means something very specific.
No, I know, but it's not the same word.
Yeah.
Last question. The things that you're, observables that you're calculating for transfer coefficients or whatever in the toy model, of the holographic one, the ones that, so that you're saying you can't actually calculate the same ones in the condensed matter side, certain ones. So, but are any of the observables that you're calculating, can any of them be measured, like, in experiment?
That's a very good question. I mean, of course, the question is, are you talking about in the dynamics, the quenchers we're going to look at here, or just more generally in equilibrium superconductors? There you can measure all sorts of, you know, I mean, all sorts of things, conductivities and so on, and
yeah,
excitations, back, you know, spectra of using photo emission and measurements like that. And then in principle, you can try and compare various things that you measure to what happens in holographic theories. But I mean, there are subtleties with holographic theories. I mean, for example, what fermions do in holographic materials is, people have proposals, but I think it's far from clear that there is a definite proposal. For example, you can propose that there's some sort of a Fermi surface in this holographic material, but I mean, there are various different proposals for how that Fermi surface works. So even at zeroth order, I mean, presumably, maybe they're all right, but you know, maybe some of them are right. So it's just very complicated. So really making contact beyond very broad phenomenology, sort of coarse phenomenology, is, I think, tricky. I think things just aren't understood that well. I mean, the trick somehow is trying to compute something that you might have some understanding what it would correspond to in a real-world material. So you always want to look at the simplest phenomena possible, things like phase structure. I mean, that's the simplest phenomena, or, you know, very, very simple different behaviors. You know, calculating very detailed things somehow is just going to, I mean, it's unclear. I don't want to be negative, but I mean, it's unclear what to compare with what.
Yeah, and another thing would be to construct a sort of realistic toy model where you have a safe site with some jumping, some interactions that might not exist in the real world. But it's not the compactification of some D-brain that you know is not there. But I don't think that exists.
I mean, some of these models you can embed. So you mean non-realistic from string perspective?
No.
You're just talking
theory, you say, okay, I can construct a holographic dual or some gauge theory, compactify, but that's not very realistic. That's clearly not the real world material.
Yeah, sure.
But you can take atoms, they say, and say, okay, they have this interaction that I make up that real atoms don't have, but at least it looks more like a material that one day you might manufacture.
Yes, I mean, it's certainly true that, you know, people might be able to manufacture all sorts of exotic materials. If you were going to manufacture an exotic material, you might want to manufacture something you thought you understood rather than something that you didn't understand. So, I mean, you know, if we ever get to that level, I'm going to start the talk again, actually. So I'm going to start by talking about BCS theory. You know, ADS CFT is very profound, and the cuprates are almost perfectly described by holographic superconductors. They're believed to be strongly coupled conformal theories, and as a yttrium, barium, blah 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 blah, blah is what I'm studying. Okay, so the vacuum geometry. I want to say a few words. Because this is going to boil down to a numerical relativity problem, I want to talk about numerical relativity because it's what I know something about rather than nothing about. And the vacuum, as you all know, ADS with Poincaré, we'll be talking about a 2 plus 1 boundary, 3 plus 1 interior, because we're trying to do something related to condensed matter physics, although I think none of that is important. It's dimension independent, you have the bulk coordinate z or z, and that's the sort of Poincaré coordinate, so it compactifies the boundary which lives at z is 0. And the field theory coordinates then are these x's. And as you all know, stuff that happens up here is sort of the UV, stuff that happens down there is the IR. As I was saying the other day, I'll just say it again because just to make more sense of what I'm doing, any bulk field has some boundary behavior, and because you have a boundary, you have to specify boundary conditions. And essentially, there's a sort of Dirichlet bit that you should, I mean, that's the usual way of doing things in ADS50 is to fix the Dirichlet data for a field. That will be a function of x, time and space in the field theory directions, and then there's some sort of the normal gradient term, if you like, it comes at higher order in this expansion. And what the idea is that you solve with all your consistent boundary conditions in the interior, fixing the Dirichlet data, and then at the end of the day, you can read off, for example, this normal gradient data. Every field in the bulk is paired with an operator in the field theory, and this boundary condition here is interpreted as a source for that operator in the field theory, and this normal data, in fact, has the beautiful interpretation as giving the VEV, or the response, of the operator to that source. So it's a very pretty picture, and of course there's a prescription holographic RG for computing higher point functions, and also it's understood how to compute other observables like Wilson loops and so on, entanglement entropy, but I won't need that more complicated structure here. I say that partly to emphasize that whilst this looks very local to get one-point functions, when you start looking at higher-point functions, you have to do rather non-local things in the bulk. It's considerably more tricky, but we'll actually just need one-point functions for this talk. I'm simple-minded. So you perturb the theory, as I was saying the other day, you could do it by just picking a state that is in the vacuum and evolving it. Or you can turn on a source dynamically on the boundary, and that throws in some energy, and there's some response to that. Now, the one thing I'd say, if you take a black hole, say a static black hole, that's a nice state to start with. It's a thermal state. We understand that state. You could pick any old state you like here. And from a point of view numerical GR, somehow the natural thing to do is to just start, you know, you solve some maybe time-symmetric initial data and evolve. But that's, I mean, it's perfectly fine. It just corresponds as taking your quantum field theory in the non-vacuum state and evolving it with the Hamiltonian. That's fine, but you don't have much control over what that state means. It's difficult to understand how you make that state or what it corresponds to. And in some sense, it's much more natural to think about turning on sources, which, you know, if you then cut it at a later time, corresponds to some non-trivial data here. But you know what made that data. You know that there are some operators you can turn on that give you that. But it's just a comment.
Yeah, but then you don't have any control over what the state in the bulk is going to be.
You don't care. I mean, what you want control over is what you're doing in the field theory.
Well, but from an analytic point of view, you're trying to understand solutions
in the bulk. Oh, I see. Well, I mean, you have some intuition for what happens. But yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, somehow the interesting question is what happens. Yeah. But I. Yeah. So there are lots of different settings where ADS can be studied, but for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to focus on these superconductors, and what we'll need is gravity. We're in four dimensions in the bulk, gravity and a vector field, and charge under the vector field is a complex scalar. And so the complex scalar has some charge. I'm going to take it to be charge 2 for entirely arbitrary reasons. It works slightly better than charge 1 in the numerics. And we're going to take this value of the mass to be the one, the conformal value for a scalar. So from the ADS-CFT point of view, this is a relevant, corresponds to a relevant operator. And this is, you know, this is a peculiar thing that in ADS you can have negative masses because when you put, if you put a negative mass theory in a box, you cut off infrared. I mean, the instability that you get from negative mass is an infrared instability. You cut it off. So it's a perfectly fine, stable theory.
Do you mean m squared there?
I do mean m squared. Indeed.
Okay.
And I may not have, I didn't think seriously about my signs this morning at whatever time it was. So. But yes, it looks naively tachyonic, but it's perfectly stable. So the important, from the point of view of the physics, the important point is that what does the vector field correspond to? It corresponds to an operator in the field theory, which is a conserved current. So it corresponds to a vector source. It corresponds to a vector operator in the field theory. But because this is a gauge field, this is a conserved vector. So it's a conserved current. And the scalar, the complex scalar, corresponds to a complex scalar operator in the boundary. And again, because of the gauge structure here, this there's a global U1. So this is a complex scalar, and it's charged under the same global U1 that this is the current, this is the conserved current for. And then the gauge field and the complex scalar have some boundary expansions. There's a sort of leading Dirichlet piece that we want to fix. That's our source. And then we want to read off the VEV for these operators. So this gives you the VEV of the current. This gives you the VEV of this complex scalar. This is the source for the complex scalar. This is the source for the current. And in particular, what we're going to be interested in is situations in this talk where we turn on the source for the current that's just in the time direction. And we're going to be interested in homogeneity in the spatial directions. So really, we've just got non-trivial time dependence. Yeah?
Can I ask a sort of technical question? I thought usually with a non-zero mass, you get sort of fractional powers in the expansion.
Yeah, so that's why...
Is
an artifact of this particular value.
Does that change things any?
It's something like you get... delta, the conformal dimension, and then 4 minus delta, or is it 3 minus delta? 3 minus delta in 4 dimensions. So in this case, we get nice integer powers. But if you took other values of that mass, you would get fractional powers. But of course, if you're doing numerics, it's much nicer to have integer powers.
Is the numerics able to handle the fractional powers, or is it just sort of more annoying to do it that way, or is the numerics?
I honestly haven't tried, so I don't know.
It's difficult. It's more difficult.
Well, I mean, I suspect the important actually the important thing is not so much it's not so much whether they're fractional or not. It's more what the relative power is, and the relative power is integer. So I suspect even if it's fractional, you probably just have to pull the fractional behavior out, and then you get a perfectly regular smooth field.
No, you get two delta.
What about the metric? When you backrace it on the metric?
Isn't that right? Sorry. Isn't the difference... Oh, sorry. No. I'm saying, the difference isn't... No, the difference isn't integer.
So
that's right.
When you do...
Yeah, no,
we don't quite understand, but it's... There are some issues.
Let me say it another way. If you didn't turn on a source for it, it would be fine, because then you would just pull out the fractional power. But if you turned on a source, then I think it's more subtle. Yeah. I haven't looked at it, and I don't think many people have played around with this anyway. Forgetting dynamics.
Is that true? If you turn off the source,
you'll have back
reaction. You still have back reaction on
sure.
the metric, so you're still not trivial.
In the linearized approximation.
I'm not going there anyway, so.
So is
it's hard enough as it is.
Is the VEV of the operator dependent on the choice of mass?
Well, I mean, the VEV of the operator, everything is dependent in some sense on the choice of the charge that you give to the complex scalar and the mass. So they're just two parameters of theory. But then beyond that, the VEV of the operator is going to be dependent on what we do with the various sources in the problem.
And the response will
So we fix our theory, of course, which theory we choose is going to affect everything. But then...
how do you know you picked... Why did you... it seems you picked that mass choice so that you would get into...
Yes. No, because I said earlier it's yttrium barium sulfide. You see? So...
Because it's a Cooper.
I see.
Otherwise, we'd just be doing something totally unconnected with real world. Anyway, enough. So then Gupta made this beautiful observation, and then later Hartnell, Horowitz, and Herzog made this more concrete in this setting, that there's this, you know, these black holes in this theory. So what we're going to do is turn on a chemical potential here. So we are deforming away from the usual ADS. We turn on a chemical potential. So this mu is going to be non-zero. But let's make it just constant, not time-dependent or anything like that. In fact, it would be trivial if it was time. I mean, it's just non-zero. That's the important thing. And they observed that, I mean, you obviously have a generalization. You have black holes, which are just a generalization of usual rise and neutron. They just charge black holes. But the scalar is zero everywhere. And so what I'm going to plot here is the value, essentially something that measures the value of the scalar in the solution. But technically, it's this VEV of the complex operator, which, if you want to know what it is technically measuring, is it's measuring this, the magnitude of that. Okay. But roughly speaking, it measures something like the strength of the amount of scalar you've got lying around. Now, the Rise and Nordstrom solution all has zero scalar, so they all live down here. Okay. But what they observed is that below a certain temperature, because you've put in a chemical potential, the system actually becomes unstable to condensation of this charged scalar. And so they found this beautiful new branch of solutions where the scalar is non-zero, and in particular, there's some profile, some interesting profile, what it does. And so this is like a Higgs mechanism in the interior of this, in the bulk, because you're spontaneously breaking this gauged U1 symmetry. And that's very reminiscent of what happens in superconductivity in BCS theory, where there is a description in terms of symmetry breaking of a complex scalar, the Higgs mechanism. And more precisely, if you look at current correlators, you see infinite conductivity of this current. So this is a charged current, and you see the DC infinite conductivity you would expect from a superconductor. So this is all beautiful old work for the, yeah, I mean, say no more about that. So obviously, as we discussed, I won't touch that one, or that one, or in fact, in the interest of time, that one. So what we're going to focus on is the dynamics of this theory, mainly motivated by the idea that dynamics is just so hard in field theory. So it's almost like the nicest, you know, if you give this phase diagram to someone, they can say, well, okay, it's a complicated theory, but I could, in principle, put it on a lattice and simulate it at finite temperature. And in principle, even if it's strongly coupled, I can solve it. But for dynamics, it's just, I mean, I think no one really knows how to do dynamics from first principles. So the state of the art, apparently, I'm told by my expert collaborators, is something, the work of Barankov and Levitov, not that long ago, and then there's been lots of follow-up work, where they basically look at approximations made in BCS theory to make the theory time-dependent. So let me... so. Does anyone know about BCS theory in detail here? Okay, then I shall proceed. So BCS theory says something like you have these fermions that live in the Fermi surface. There's a Fermi surface, you have fermions. The excitations, we think of them as electrons, and some, or really you should think of them as quasi-particles. And they're weakly coupled quasi-particles, so there's some good... you know, you have control over them in terms of their nature as quasi-particles. But there's some, and generically, there will be some sort of interactions between these quasi-particles on the Fermi surface. And in BCS theory, you write down a Hamiltonian that describes these quasi-particles themselves, and then some interaction term, a pairing interaction between quasi-particles that wants to pair different spins. Now, in standard BCS theory, so this term is just the sort of energy that controls, this is a potential for the quasi-particles themselves, but this term here then controls the strength of this pairing interaction. and depending on what you do with that, you may have a condensation of pairs of spins or not. But in standard BCS theory, that's just a constant.
Okay, so what is P, Q, and epsilon?
So, sorry, P is the momentum of the fermions. Sigma would be the spin, so it's plus or minus a half. And Q is the momentum of the other spin. So this is a sum over the momenta of a single species. This is a pairing interaction between different fermions with different spins and different momenta. And this approximation, this is a mean field approximation, so you basically throw out any spatial variation. And in this time-dependent work, one is also going to throw out any sort of dissipative phenomena. So this model, just as it's written here, what Barinkov and Levitov did is trying to solve this model where you make this time dependent. And so it's in a mean field approximation. There's no damping. There's no collisional damping. There's no sort of thermal physics in
that. Is that why you assume opposite spins and opposite momentum?
Well, I mean, I'm going to defer the answer because, I mean, I'm really genuinely so unfamiliar with these sort of things.
But that's a pairing term that you put in there to get the Cooper pairs. I think thermal physics would just be something else.
Oh, indeed, yes. But, I mean, that's right. I mean, depending on what you meant by, I mean, there are various forms of dissipative effects. I mean, you could have sort of scattering off phonons in your material, and then I'm not even sure you could describe it in a sort of Hamiltonian form. The energy here in this system will be conserved, so manifestly it's not dissipative. And what these guys did was they then said, well, let's make this a function of time, and we'll just make it a step or a sharp transition between some value, some initial value lambda s, and some final value lambda. So you're just changing this coupling. Obviously, time, there's some quench time, and you're just going to change it discontinuously. And the question is, what does the system do? And they write down some state for the theory. So it starts in the ground state of the original theory, and then it's going to evolve. And the trick is to understand the evolution. And so there's some equations that determine, I mean, you can, in these approximations, you can solve for the time dependence of these and actually get the wave function that solves this. You can compute the expected number, the VEV of the condensate, if you like, of the pairing, the number operator for the pairs is basically given like that. And just in terms of terminology, the initial pairing corresponding to this lambda S, let's call it delta S. So there is some, we're imagining starting in the theory where you do have some condensate. And then the final pairing, if you were in equilibrium, if you hadn't done anything, the final pairing would be delta naught. But the actual delta we're going to get, we're not in equilibrium because you've pumped energy in and it can't dissipate. So it's not going to settle. Delta, it doesn't settle down to delta naught. That's a potential point of confusion.
When they do this discussion, so do they really evolve across the quench or they use the quench just to prepare?
They use the quench in absolutely to prepare it, yes.
An initial state.
Yes, yes. Because it's infinitely sharp, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So what it is essentially is it's just like this Bogoliubov transformations, like in Hawking radiation. You have one vacuum, you have another vacuum, but there's some non-analytic relation between them that gives you particle creation. That's exactly what's happening here. You start out in the vacuum here, you change your Lagrangian. And you're just not in a vacuum state, and there's some particle creation associated with that, some dynamics, and that's precisely what they're doing. But even that seems to be, from the look of the papers and the subsequent papers, very, very complicated. It reduces to some integrable system, and then there's solitons in this integrable system, and they use, they somehow use horrendous techniques to solve all of this.
But in principle, they could have removed the quench and just simply said that time t equals p star plus zero.
Yeah.
That's my initial state.
Yeah.
And so
I'm
going to evolve the system.
But, I mean, it's precisely what they're doing, yeah.
Okay.
It's precisely what they're doing. But that, I want to emphasize, seems to be tremendously hard.
Yeah, sure. Can it not be solved theoretically? Because it's quantum mechanics.
Well, they're able to solve it analytically, so yes, I'm sure it can be solved numerically. Yeah. But I mean, you have to understand there are various approximations have gone into this. So this isn't meant to just, I mean, what is unclear from their work, they've managed to work very hard and in subsequent papers solve this analytically, which seems to be tremendously complicated to do. But I want to emphasize there are various important physical assumptions that have gone into just starting point. Yeah.
Can I,
sure.
Now, in experiments, so what in experiments, it's hard to imagine that that's the way how you would think about the quench, right? So in experiment, you would think really you sort of do the evolution across the quench. So is that something?
But I don't think there's any difference to thinking about evolving or just starting in a different Hamiltonian.
I think
for this type of quench, they're completely the same. I mean, if you have some smooth variation, then of course it's more complicated.
Right.
Let me just say one other thing. There are two obvious limits for this sort of dynamics. One is a very adiabatic dynamics, and then one is the very sharp dynamics. And what they're interested in is the sharp dynamics.
But in experiments, I know that's a series that they do. But in experiments, presumably people can talk. Can you comment on experiments? So what do they do? So what do they do in experiments? What is the analog of
my
finality, what exactly are they doing?
I don't know.
Okay.
And I think the important. I mean, I want to stress this isn't. This is still not realistic enough that it describes some experiment that's being done. I don't think they're claiming this is something you can do in a lab. What they're claiming is this is something you can solve, and there's some phenomena. That's as far as I understand. Now, my condensed matter colleagues probably know far more about this than I do.
This is not so much different from ADS-CFT, right?
Sorry, it's... No, that's what I want to emphasize. No, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. You start with a theory that you want to understand. You make a load of approximations. You can do something, but it's unclear what... That tells you, and then you start with a material that doesn't really look like what you want, but you don't have to make any approximations further.
Opposite.
You know, that's exactly the point.
I think that the question is whether these approximations are something that you have control over. Maybe as CMT, we don't have any. I mean, we don't know how far or how close we are to the reality.
But they don't know here either.
They don't know here either. So then it's the same.
I mean, it really is the same. I think. So it shouldn't. Yeah. Now, let me get on with it. So what they obtain is what they call a dynamical phase diagram. And in particular, so I don't know if you remember, but this was the ratio of the starting sort of condensate or pairing or gap, the amount of superconducting pairs that have condensed, divided by what would have been the equilibrium value if you were just in a theory just at constant final value lambda. So roughly speaking, this tells you how much you've changed your theory. So when it's small, you've hardly done anything. You've hardly changed lambda, or you've hardly changed the amount of the conducting pairing. And if you crank it up, you've changed a lot. And what they see is not at all. I mean, it's not that counterintuitive. You measure the final behavior of the pairing. If you hardly kick the system at all. You just get you've put in some energy, you're not in the new ground state, but you're just in some state sort of fairly close, and it just oscillates between the true ground state and the true final ground state and your initial state, and the energy is such that it sort of just keeps this state oscillating between the two things. So these two curves are actually the magnitude of the oscillation. I think this is the mean value. Okay, so it just oscillates. And there's no damping, so that energy can't go away. But in particular, it oscillates right up to what would be the true equilibrium value of the gap, which would be 1. But if you kick it more, at some point it stops oscillating and actually settles down. There's some power law decay. they claim. It settles down to some equilibrium value, which isn't one, so it doesn't settle down to the value it would have had if this was its lambda, because there's some energy in the system and it can't get out. And that energy sort of breaks, I suppose the interpretation is it breaks up the Cooper pairs. It wants to knock them around, so there's less condensate around, but there is nonetheless condensate. And then if you kick it enough, you go to a third regime where you just have no pairing at all. Okay? So normally this theory, if this was constant, would have pairing, but you've dumped so much energy in that it basically breaks up. It stops the things pairing. They say it dephases the Cooper pairs. But the key point is that there's you stay in the superconducting phase over here for small quenches, and you have oscillating behavior, then damped behavior, and then you have damped behavior to just to the normal phase, the non-superconducting phase. And that's basically what they say. And the question is, does that survive all these approximations? Can you see that in experiment and so on?
Can they compute the effective temperature in the end? Like how much?
I don't think they have an effective temperature. I don't think it's thermal. Well, it's far from clear that it's... I mean, you know, there's this work of Cardi and Calabrese, for example, which is very famous, and it does similar sort of things where you just change the Hamiltonian at some point, where that's in the conformal theory. And then you see, you can sort of interpret things as thermal, but they're not really, I mean, they're not really thermal. I mean, there's some spectrum of energy in your theory, but I mean, there's no dissipation. I mean, there's no, I mean, in particular, this is boils down to an integrable system. And you know in an integrable system, I mean, it can't possibly thermalize. It's precisely a theory which can't thermalize. But it might look, yeah.
Why is the neglect of dissipation a good approximation?
I don't know. Well, it's all you can do, I think, is the point. That's you know, it's all you can do. But then maybe there are experiments where, I think in cold atoms, you can, if they're very, very cold, you can actually have, you can make the dissipation very small compared to the timescales you're looking at. But honestly, I just don't know enough about it. And I think, and the question is, does this survive? I mean, they have some phenomenological models for putting in dissipation into this picture, but it's not from first principles, it's just ad hoc.
So in this dephasing regime, there is no oscillations.
No.
So it's a power law.
Yeah. So here you have a power law decay to this equilibrium value in the final state, whereas if here you just have a persistent oscillation about some value between these values.
So presumably if you were at zero temperature, you wouldn't... Sorry?
There's no temperature here. There's no temperature at all.
No, right. In this case. Right. So that's why it oscillates permanently between the two.
Yes, not only you at zero temperature, but there's no like lattice that it can scatter off or anything like that. There's no way to dissipate any energy. Right. So what we're going to do, as we say, we're going to take our yttrium, barium, whatever it is, and we'll start with a superconducting state. We'll throw in some energy by turning on some source. We'll just perturb it in some way. And we'll see what happens. That's the, oh, I'm so sorry. That's the black hole.
So you are.
That's the black hole horizon. This is the boundary.
So you are doing a thermal quench instead of what they
do. So we are going to do a thermal quench. We're going to start, as I say, we'll start with as low a temperature solution as we can reasonably do. So we want to start off at small temperature. But as you know, in ADS-CFT, when you throw in some energy, it does that. You know, what does it do? In Poincaré slice, at least, it creates a black hole. So you do get what looks like a thermal state. So in some sense, you automatically do better than anything people can do in condensed matter, although it's, you know, swings and roundabouts. I mean, you don't understand that thermal state, but, you know, we understand it through Hawking and so on, but
you could also
really.
Start earlier without a black hole and then turn the source at a later time.
Yeah.
You could start at zero temperature.
You could start at zero temperature. So I can't start at zero temperature doing what I'm doing now,
right.
But you could start at zero temperature.
No, but the point was zero temperature was an extremal black hole.
I'm simple-minded.
Zero temperature would be an extremal black hole in your...
Yeah. So actually in this, I mean, strictly speaking, in the theory, I'm looking at zero temperature as singular in the infrared. It's a good singularity. So But you could start at very low temperature, but then there are other models where you don't have singularity. I mean, it's a bit of a can of worms. But I don't think it's, I mean, the important point is it's not that, none of these things are that important. We'll just start at a low temperature. And, but it is interesting that in the final state you are thermal.
Well, I guess the question that I probably would postpone until you start talking about quasi-normal models, because...
If I start.
Well, if we use the chair, it's nice. But the question is, it's important whether or not you have a black hole, because eventually it is a black hole that would characterize the spectrum
of
your relaxation.
And that's what we'll
find. And that's very different when you have, Cooper pair, sort of there. The spectrum of relaxation is controlled by the binding energy.
But the same is true here. I mean, if you took a soliton solution, for example, it has some spectrum of normal modes. It doesn't have quasi-normal modes. It has some spectrum of normal modes. I mean, the only difference between having a black hole and not having a black hole is that you have dissipative spectrum rather than just normal modes. I mean, if you settle down, I mean, it's just linear response. If you settle down to some equilibrium solution, the spectrum of that control the rate of settling down. But I agree with what you're saying, yeah. So I just want to point out that there was some very nice previous work by Murata and colleagues where they looked. What they did was they did precisely the sort of thing we're doing, or in the sense that they're simulating a superconducting theory. But they what they did was they started in this unstable phase here and then just perturbed it and watched the evolution into the broken phase. So it's very nice work, but quite different physical setup. And they didn't perturb it by sending stuff in from the boundary. It was a perturbation in the interior. But nonetheless, we're using very similar methods to what they did. It's very nice work. Okay, so let's get to the gravity. So Birkhoff's theorem tells you that when you have the symmetry that we have, the homogeneous symmetry in the field theory directions, Birkhoff didn't. Birkhoff would have been horrified at ADS-CFT, but Birkhoff tells you that roughly spin 2 particles can't radiate, but it's also true spin 1 particles can't radiate. So the only dynamics in this theory is the complex scalar. The only really dynamical field is the complex scalar. And so that's slightly unpretty, inelegant, because it means that the only source that we can really deform the theory by is the source for the complex scalar. But the complex scalar is the thing that tells us about this condensate. It is the order parameter for this phase structure between the broken superconducting and normal phase. So you're turning on a source for it. I mean, it's what that corresponds to in the experiment, I just don't know. Or rather, Subiac-Sachdev says it's like turning on a chemical potential for the condensate. And I mean, he had this beautiful observation, if you put 2 superconductors next to each other, you might be able to inject Cooper pairs from one into the other. But I mean, it's not far from what you do in other systems. If you maybe studying magnetism, you might apply a magnetic field and observe the response of the, magnetization or so on. But that's all we can do in a simple model. If you go to more complicated models, so you've other things that you could kick the system with. But
so your chemical potential.
And we have and absolutely in all of this we have a chemical potential.
But that basically what you're saying in all this theory is that you cannot give time dependence to a chemical potential.
Yes.
Why? Okay.
It's gauge. It's gauge. Yes, so if you just tried to turn on the chemical potential, as I did when the title of this paper was Chemical Potential Quenches in Superconductors, you solve the dynamics and you find it just gauge rotates the fields in the bulk. And you can prove analytically that it's just a gauge rotation.
Even in the presence of the black hole.
Well, without the hair, it doesn't do anything.
Right.
But with the hair, it phase rotates the... So there's some beautiful dynamics, and then you realize it doesn't do anything.
So one thing you could do is to turn on a homogeneous but anisotropy mode of the metric, the boundary metric, but no, you don't want...
Yeah, one thing I can't do is that, but one could do it, absolutely. I mean, that's got much less symmetry, right?
Well, you break isotropy, you would settle down eventually.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're saying break one direction.
It's a shear mode.
I see. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Okay. That's a good point. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what that would I don't know what you're doing. I mean, I suppose the point that I wanted to make is that I suppose it doesn't really matter what you do. What I'm going to say is going to be fairly general for whatever you kick. But indeed, you could do that. That's right. The other thing to say is that vortices, because you're going from the broken phase into the normal phase, I mean, if you were doing things the other way, if you're worrying about sort of cooling the normal phase and transitioning into the broken phase, then you get the dynamics terribly wrong if you assume homogeneity when you have a second order phase transition because of the Kibble-Zurek mechanism. You form vortices and defects, whereas here, that doesn't happen. We're going the other way. So again, this sort of the approximation of mean field in the field theory context is fine here, right? We understand in ADS-EFT that at large n, this sort of when you truncate to homogeneity, modulo sort of dynamics like vortex formation or something, it seems to be, you know, mean field is good, it's perfectly fine. You're not throwing out anything important. So we work, I mean, technically what we do is we follow essentially sort of the approach that Chesler and Yaffe took in the sort of context of thermalization and so on that they were studying. And it's also an approach taken by Murata, but we're probably... And so we take ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. We work with a z-coordinate and then the Eddington-Finkelstein time, which is just the normal time on the boundary. You have the real and imaginary parts of the scalar and then the gauge field in time. We pick the gauge so there's no gauge field in z. And then t and s. There are five equations that you can use to evolve these various fields, and then there are three more equations that are constraints. And you can, without going into the details, provided you've satisfied, when you think about the equations, you find that, can you see if I, so we've got the black hole horizon here, this isn't really a conformal diagram. And sort of Eddington-Finkelstein slices, in some sense, do this. And given boundary condition here, and then data here, you can advance to the next step, and then advance to the next step, and so on. And that's how you build up the geometry. And the boundary conditions are here. If we separate out the source terms that we want to sort of hold fixed and deform the system by, then what we remain with just have simple Dirichlet boundary conditions at the boundary, so they're just set to zero at the boundary, and there's one additional subtlety that you have to enforce one of these constraint equations at the boundary, and that's consistent because one of these evolution equations isn't really an evolution equation, it's an elliptic equation. And it's a second order elliptic equation. And so there are actually two bits of data you need to give at the boundary. So it's not just a Dirichlet condition, there's something else, and that's determined when you go through all the rigmarole of the Graham-Pfefferman by this. And that essentially is just energy conservation. That ensures stress energy conservation of the stress tensor in the field theory.
So when you are doing the quench, you never change the non-normalizable component.
This is the non-normalizable.
That's your quench.
And this, of course, is. So we turn on a chemical potential. Right. Let's say we just, it's a choice of, it's a gauge choice in the bulk what that chemical, I mean, it has to be non-zero, but it's a gauge choice what it does. But let's say, for example, we just leave it constant.
Right.
Then you have to specify this as a function of time, and this is the non-normalizable
right.
mode. Okay. And that's precisely what throws in the energy.
Not a corresponding constraint for current conservation?
That's interesting. I think there is, but I guess it's in the spatial directions. Is that right? So, well, maybe it's...
It could be that it's trivial for some reason here, but I would have thought there's another interesting equation to correspond to.
Yeah, Gino, I mean, it's a good...
I mean, this comes from some diffeomorphism constraint, so there must be some gauge constraint.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I suppose I didn't, when I said stress energy conservation, I just looked at all the equations, you find the constraints, and then you look at the,
yeah, no,
you know.
But, you can,
but I, so I haven't, maybe it's, Yeah, it's a good question. I haven't sort of picked out exactly, I haven't looked at the stress energy conservation equation and written it out and so on in the expansion. It's a good question. I don't know.
But the wave equation for the scalar field will basically be isn't that the same as the jet?
Oh, but sorry. I think it is trivial. I think it's trivial, right? In homogeneity, you wouldn't expect to have a current. I mean, the current conservation is sort of trivial. Your current can't go anywhere. How's it not going to be conserved? I mean, it cannot be conserved because of the dynamic. Maybe this is a combination of stress energy and current conservation.
Well, I think current conservation should tell you that the normalizable mode of the cage field. So the charge density, so to speak, right? The conjugate variable to mu is constant. Because it reads dTHAT plus DIJI equals zero, but all the DIs are zero. So you get dTJT is zero, and JT is the bed of AT.
But J is expressed in terms of grad phi. And when you write down div of J, you're basically just writing down the wave equation. And if you're already doing the wave equation, you must automatically be building the current conservation.
I think that's right. Maybe that's right. Yes.
Well, we can talk about it more later, right?
So then that suggests the symmetry make that trivial, right? That's why. Okay. I'm not sure. Anyway, just from the point of view of the equations, it's all.
He's not, but he should be able to.
No, but everything's homogeneous. You know, Jeff, in charge. What can the charge density?
So we'll start with some initial data. So the initial data we take is one of these hairy black holes, and we'll try and take as low a temperature as we can. But when you get to very low temperatures, because they're singular, at zero temperature strictly you've got a curvature singularity, it actually becomes numerically hard. So we don't start at very, very low temperature, we start at quite low temperatures. And then, as I say, you choose some, whatever your favorite function of time is, for this complex field on the boundary, and we're going to take some sort of sharp Gaussian, and that will inject energy into the system. And then you would want to examine, for example, the normal gradient of this, the normal gradient of this, its modulus will give us the BEV of the of this operator that is thought to be dual to the Cooper, or the condensate in the superconductor. And actually, the numerical method, the peculiar thing about all of this that I have no particular understanding of is, when you do all this with the boundary conditions here, you just, at the end of your grid here, you choose the end of your grid to be slightly inside the horizon of your initial black hole solution. And then as you evolve, you just don't need any boundary condition. You just do nothing with the end of your grid at all. And of course, in the continuum, we're perfectly happy with causality, meaning that that's fine. The interesting thing is that I use these pseudo-spectral or Chebyshev methods in space, and they're horribly non-local. So it's sort of peculiar that it works so well, but it really does seem to work. Anyway, so this is an evolution. So for example, here's Z, and here's time V, which is just this is the boundary of the space, and this is the real part of the complex scalar, and we perturbed the source we took a sharp Gaussian centered on time 1, which is width the tenth. So it's very sharp and it's got some strength delta. And in fact direction. I mean, it's a complex scalar, and you start in the broken phase. So you've picked out some direction in the vacuum manifold, this U1, and we kick it in the orthogonal direction to that, just because numerically it just seems to be nice. But also, physically, you're doing more to inject energy into the system if you do that than if you kick it in the other way, when you're sort of more injecting condensate. Subtracting condensate. So given that there's only one source we can play with, it just seems a bit more natural to take the situation where you try to not inject condensate, inject as little condensate as possible, but just inject energy. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, you get the same phenomenology whatever you do.
Was it you say the same thing?
So, about how we're kicking it.
Well, you were saying some things that you're not injecting the energy, right? So what do you mean?
No. So you start in the broken phase, right. And in the broken phase, the complex scalar can be chosen just to be, say, real. And then the question is, how are you going to kick it? Are you going to, the source is complex.
Right.
So do you kick it with a real source or an imaginary source or some combination or a time-dependent complex source? And in some sense, we don't really want to kick it. I mean, I'm not pretending this is a real-world material, so I don't think it's important. But if you did think it was important, you wouldn't really want, you don't really think in a superconductor that you're going to turn on this potential for the condensate itself. You would be doing something else to inject energy. So you don't really want to kick it in the direction of the condensate. You probably want to kick it in a different direction.
But the quality depends you're
going to
extract.
But as I would emphasize it, you just get the same. I mean, it really doesn't. This is what we're doing for this. And,
was delta small?
Here's delta's 0.3, but remember, it's very, very,
it's
very steep. Oh, yes, it's not that small. No, this is not totally nonlinear. And because this is so steep, this has got a lot of energy. I mean, and you can see what happens is you start with this sort of static configuration, which is your initial state. And then after some, when you get to time one, it gets kicked by this energy, this huge energy, this energy that blasts in. Because obviously in Eddington Finkelstein, these slices are null. So this blasts in. There's some dynamics after, and then in this case, it's settled down to some static configuration again, which is, of course, another hairy black hole. With a higher temperature because you throw an energy in. So I'm running over time. So this is the metric function T, some dynamics. I won't show you all of the, but it's. So this actually shows you what happens to the apparent horizon. It's got some complicated dynamics, but initially it's at a constant position. And after you've kicked, so we arrange it initially to be at the other end of your grid. And then finally, it's come in some sense in this coordinate system as the black hole gets hotter. The horizon comes in, and you're simulating here. This region is the interior of the black hole. One thing you have to be slightly careful of is that if you run too long, it seems that you run into the singularity, because Eddington Finkelstein goes inside. There's nothing to stop you hitting the actual singularity of the black hole. So if I was more cunning, I would have then regridded here and then evolved, but I'm not, so I didn't. So what you see looks remarkably similar to this sort of Barankov-Levertov situation, which isn't terribly surprising. So this is the final bev of the complex scalar, so the final condensate. This is the kick. For a very small kick, you don't do very much. So this is close to the initial condensate bev. If you don't kick it very much, you just stay a superconductor in the final state. And then this comes down. And then if you kick over a critical amount for this particular choice of Gaussian, you then go into the normal phase. You put in so much energy that you've gone through this phase transition. So people call this a dynamical phase diagram.
And if you do it more smoothly, then, so if you just take your Gaussian and make it very, very slowly burn, you always stay there.
There'll always be some, yes, it'll just look very smooth. Yeah.
Still a bigger line.
Remember the dotted line.
Okay, can I ask another question? So,
it's always good advice.
aside from the way you kick it in video,
yep.
Can I understand this physics by saying that however complicatedly I kick it, if I look at the total amount of energy that I have injected, if that energy is big enough so that if I imagine that it will settle down to a black hole with an effective temperature given by this energy, that effective temperature is above the critical temperature, then...
Yeah. That's precisely what's happening, yeah. It's precisely the same physics that was happening in BCS if you... throw in enough energy, you in this case you dephase the condensate. In this Yeah, but it's
so it gets too hot and then
it gets too hot. Yeah, yeah. These are quite fragile things.
Even though you are saying you are kicking it violently, but it doesn't look like you are kicking it too violently because you are not exciting quasi-normal models of your scale with you. I don't see. Right. So,
oh, no, sorry. Let me be very clear. Oh, I'm so sorry. I think there's some confusion. This is the final value of the scalar.
So it's not.
This is not time. This is the size of the kick.
Okay. Sorry.
Yes, this is very important.
But
we'll come on to that. Yeah. This is the size of the kick. Now you can then reinterpret this diagram. You can say, well, what is the final black hole I land up with? It's got some temperature, and so you can plot this against temperature. And precisely what you're going to recover is just the phase diagram of the equilibrium solution. So there's no surprise there, and it's a good check of the numerics. The reason the points don't agree here is not because there's a problem with the numerics, but just because when I extract the final value, you see, I run the simulation for a certain time, and then just take the value of the scalar at that time to be the final value. Now, when you get very near to the phase transition point here, the time scale for relaxation becomes very, very long. Essentially because the lowest quasi-normal modes become, you know, they're the things that go to have zero frequency at the phase transition point. They give you the marginal mode. So the dynamics takes longer and longer to relax in the region just near here. So it's not at all surprising. I mean, I just very naively extracted these points.
Sure.
You could probably do a more sophisticated job or try and run simulations longer. Eventually, this curve would line up here. But you can check the geometry of these solutions. You can check all the properties, and they are the equilibrium solution.
There's a critical point, a critical kick, you cannot measure.
Exactly to here.
But you cannot measure from the numerics the critical exponent.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah.
And you guess that it should
be
the same. Say that again. Why do you say that?
Well,
yes,
I mean, if you want to measure the critical exponent.
Yes, yes.
And if that goes sharply, there's going to be a critical exponent, but you cannot resolve that. I mean, that's maybe not surprising because you're in the critical
But if this
point.
Is the static phase diagram, you can just measure critical exponent from static.
Oh, sorry. Yes, exactly. Well,
and this is just
the field. No. But I guess what the question is whether this is sharp or not. And I think the point. So again, similarly, these points are naively evaluated. So I don't know actually what the behavior of the curve is here. I don't know if it's sharp or not.
But you could start it.
Sorry. What am I saying? It must be sharp. It must be sharp.
I think it should be sharp.
It must
right?
be sharp. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. I don't. Yeah. Okay. And this is the final temperature against delta, and I guess what you're talking about is here, it looks smooth, but I guess, yeah, I mean, this is precisely the bit which isn't correct, and it should be shown. So, sorry, I hadn't appreciated that at all. Good. So what does the actual time dependence look like? Here's the VEV, the magnitude of the VEV, of the associated with the bulk scalar. This is time. This is a small kick, so this is, in this phase diagram, sorry, this curve should go right down here. In this phase diagram, you've started at about this temperature, and we've kicked it a relatively small amount, and it's gone to here, but just to show you where we are. And you kick it, and then you relax down to some value here, but you can see some oscillations. This possibly isn't the clearest example. You see some oscillatory behavior. And in fact, this red curve, as I'll discuss later, is the quasi-normal mode for that final state. So then you can see it determined using different methods, and it agrees very nicely, as you would imagine.
Why was this BL like?
Oh, I'll tell you later.
Okay.
If you kick it a bit more, so we started here. The first picture I showed you was kicking it to there. The second picture is kicking it to here. You can see that it relaxes to some new non-zero value, as we were saying, but it's got no oscillations. Just exponentially decays. And if you kick it enough, so we've now kicked it all the way to here, it relaxes to zero exponentially, no oscillation.
So that I don't understand. What, so you're kicking a black hole with a lot of energy, and it's in a short time scale. Why wouldn't it oscillate?
I mean, this, I should just be careful. This feature here, this transient behavior, is where you're kicking it. So I wouldn't, I mean, in the region where you're pumping energy in, which is around one, clearly you'll have complicated transient behaviors. But the question is, once you've turned off your source, you know, how does it approach equilibrium? And it does this. But why? It's because it's, I mean, the black hole's dissipative, so energy wants to fall in. So you have to ask, why would it oscillate or why would it not oscillate?
But the black hole also ring, so I mean, we know that...
No. Compact black holes ring. You know, these black holes don't ring, actually. I mean, the normal phase black holes don't ring. Or at least they don't ring for the degrees of freedom I'm looking at here.
And the previous
blood, did it ring? Oh, sorry. Well, this is a... So in the normal phase... that. Yeah, we'll get onto this. Let me say more, and then it may become more clear. This is precisely where we're going. So, in fact, you don't just see this structure that you have broken phase solutions and then normal phase transition. You see a finer structure, which is that you approach the final value here in an oscillatory way. You approach the final value here in an exponentially decaying way, and likewise here it's damped. So this corresponds very much to this dephasing region and the oscillatory region of Barenkov and Levertov. I mean, it just looks, the diagram just looks the same. And this line, this T star over TC, which is about 0.8, is where we estimate the transition to be. Okay? So I'm not, you know, in some sense that's the punchline. I'll say more about why this happens, but in some sense that's the punchline. Naively, you're doing something very different, but actually it looks like that behavior seems to be rather robust. Now, why does this work? Well, it's easy to understand. I mean, in some sense, the dynamical simulation is almost overkill. I mean, you need to know that the dynamics does what you expect it to do, and that quasi-normal modes are a pretty good approximation to the interesting features in the dynamics. And as you can see here, once you've turned off your source, actually, they do a terribly good job, as you might expect, at least when you're away from the critical region. They do a pretty good job of reproducing the physics. So it all must be in the quasi-normal modes, and indeed it all is. And there's a very pretty structure. So if you look, these are data, the quasi-normal modes, rather than just a diagram. In the normal phase, so we're above the critical temperature, this is what the quasi-normal modes look like. So I'm plotting the frequency as e to the minus I omega times the time, so everything should be in the lower half of the complex plane, otherwise you have instabilities. There's also a symmetry, a mirror reflection symmetry from time reversal and charge conjugation, which means the right side should look like the left side. And, okay, so we see this pattern of quasi-normal modes, so clearly you say these are the ones that are lowest imaginary part, so they have some exponential decay, you would imagine, and these are going to be the ones that last longest, because they're closest to this real axis. And then you ask yourself, well, hang on, but they've got a real component, so why doesn't this thing oscillate? And the reason it doesn't oscillate is because we're looking at the complex scale and we're looking at its magnitude. And so it's the trivial fact that if you take a complex field that goes like this, and then you take its expectation value, you project out. I mean, you're not sensitive to the phase. So there is oscillation in these modes, but it's not visible in the magnitude of the condensate, which is what if this is indeed a superconductor, we're trying to look at. So basically, because the symmetry isn't spontaneously broken, it really doesn't matter in the normal phase where the poles are. You'll always have exponential decay, provided you don't have branch cuts.
Sorry, I got a little confused by this. So if I take a black hole with two real scalar fields, so gravity with two scalar fields,
yeah,
presumably, generically, each of them will have quasi-normal modes, and both will be damped. And now you say I combine them into a complex field?
Yes, so they've got exactly the same dynamics, and then you take this, you know, you take, I mean, this is taking a very specific combination of them. It's taking precisely the combination that cancels out the oscillation.
No, but both, I mean, each of them is in magnitude, both, if I think of them as two real scale fields, in magnitude, both of them are decreasing. Right? So the if I combine them into a complex quantity, the modulus should still be decreasing.
Yes, so maybe...
I don't understand how the magnitude
is on that. These two fields are not independent. I mean, they are. They have to. There's a boundary condition for this complex scalar at the future horizon, which means that I mean, you want, you know, if you just take two real fields and just arbitrarily think about combining them, it's unclear. I mean, you know, when you have a complex scalar, there are sort of there are the sort of physical positive energy states that go forward in time and some negative energy ones that go back. So you can't just do arbitrary things with them. You have to, I mean, you literally, I'm not sure how to say it, but you can't just, it's not the same situation, is what I want to say.
If instead of looking at this norm, we're looking at the, say, some metric variable, that has to oscillate.
The metric, yes, the metric will indeed have some oscillations, and the phase of this field has some oscillations.
So what is the reason?
No. Hang on. So in the normal phase, the metric perturbations decouple from the scalar perturbations.
Sure,
so they actually don't have the same.
No, I don't care.
Frequencies.
So the black hole. I'm thinking from the ball point of view. The black hole is trying to radiate in six or seven way, and it's going.
But there are no dynamics in the graviton in the gravity field.
But the gravity field, the fact that they have a mass in the black hole, there is.
But there's no dynamics in the gravity field.
Or if you look at any other quantity.
Well, this is the only field that has dynamics in. And because you're in the normal phase, the scalar perturbation decouples from everything else. So actually, beyond this, in the normal phase, there's nothing.
So Luis, this is exactly the same what happens in asymptotic Lewis-Black space, and when you look at quasi-circular linears,
but
Ringdahl doesn't show up.
We've looked at the other points, the one that Alex described, and so there, if we have very adiabatic perturbation, something that the typical length scale of your perturbation is much longer than the length scale of the black hole, then you just have. There is no quasi-normal. Only when they become about commensurate or below that, then you see.
Have to be careful. In the adiabatic case, I mean, as soon as you start doing things whose timescales are less than the timescale of the lowest quasi-normal mode, the quasi-normal mode then have nothing to do with your system.
Absolutely, that's what I'm saying.
So
here,
completely
you're
opposite.
The opposite version. So your timescale
is much quicker. So you're dominated by the quasi-normal
mode. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's strange to me that you don't see it. So I'm with.
I think this argument is sort of quite simple.
It's also saying that nothing oscillates.
That
there are no metric variables that oscillate.
The phase oscillates. Yeah, the phase in the complex scalar does oscillate.
So
it's just that we're not trying to.
Oscillate. And that explains why the real and imaginary part oscillates separately.
Yeah. But you are measuring the combination that doesn't. Precisely.
Sorry, but when you talk to
there's no more physics than this.
I'm sorry, when you say quasi-normal modes over here, you mean on a static background, right?
We are homogeneous, right? We're homogeneous and static metric.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the normal phase, there is no condensate of the quasi-normal mode, and so you just look for, there is no condensate for this scalar field psi, and you just look basically...
Yep.
Quasi-normal mode of the scalar field in the black hole.
Yeah.
And
so then as you approach the transition temperature, precisely, I mean, what happens is these lowest modes go towards the origin, and then at the transition temperature, this is illustration, not data. At the transition temperature, this one, these are data. The transition temperature, they go to there. And of course, that marginal mode then is precisely the mode that generates the new branch of solutions. And then as you come down, as you go below the transition temperature, one of these modes sits at the origin. Now, what is it? Well, of course, when you have one of these hairy black holes, you still have a global U1 phase rotation that you can do to it. That's trivial. And then you have another mode. The other mode is the Higgs mode. The massive mode. And so this is the massive mode. It proceeds down here, and you're left with this sort of trivial phase rotation. So this, in some sense, this one's really trivial, but it, you know, it's trying to explain why you have two modes coming in here and only one coming, you know, one real mode coming out. It's because it's to do with this symmetry breaking. And because of the reflection symmetry left-right, this one must then stay on the axis. It can't do anything else.
So those are modes.
I mean, the conservation of poles. Yeah.
So those ones are in the broken phase.
So now we're just below the right. Transition temperature. This is in the broken phase.
So presumably, if you were to look at quasi-normal modes in the unbroken phase, they would simply cross.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, sorry. So in the unbroken phase, these would go through here to the transition point, and then above, and there would be instabilities,
right,
which would tell you that you're in the wrong phase.
So do you see some signs of power law behavior in the dynamical evolution close to TC?
There's no... I don't know. No, I think it's just exponential, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it's just exponential. You don't have any cuts or any complicated...
You already gave a talk, and
yeah.
I made him talk for an hour and a half. So
yeah, no, no. I'm basically done, thank you.
No, you should have to finish, but...
No.
So
this chap comes down, and I have to apologize. I realize someone has computed these, and I can't remember who, and I'm very naughty, bad Toby, this is not new. These are new. No one's done the broken phase calculation because it's a bit of a mess, but why would you do it? But unless there was some reason to do it. And then the point is, in the broken phase, you could ask, well, hang on, why? Okay, so what does this do? Well, now, one important point is these are oscillations about some non-trivial configuration, but the dominant mode here is this one on the axis. There's no real part, so there's nothing to oscillate. It's just exponential. It's overdamped. There's no oscillation at all. However, what happens is this young man here, these two fine ladies come up, this comes down. At some point, there's a transition where this mode now doesn't dominate, these do, and at lower temperatures, you're dominated by modes that do oscillate, and the argument before that you don't have oscillation goes away, because once you've got a non-trivial VEV that you're oscillating about, when you take the modulus, of course, that does now oscillate. And so that's the physics, and you can compute, this is the data, this is the transition temperature, this is the normal phase, this is the imaginary part telling you about the damping here. That mode then, this is the one that sails down the axis in the broken phase. This is the other pair that come up. And at some point, you see you have a transition for which one has the slowest decay. And that transition is this dotted line, T star. So you can calculate that just from the quasi-normal modes. And of course, it agrees with the numerics. This is the real part of the other one. Anyway. So the sort of punchline is that so one thing we'd like to say is that at low temperatures, it seems very reasonable to expect oscillations in these superconducting systems, just because at very low temperature, it's really about the hair rather than the hair is the scalar, and then you've got a black hole, but at very low temperatures, the black hole is sort of largely irrelevant. The hair's all outside, and so the quasi-normal modes associated with the scalar are going to be outside the black hole, and they're not going to have much overlap to dissipate, so presumably there's going to be a strong oscillatory component. And then you see this very general structure predicts that at low temperatures, whatever you would expect oscillations, and then there's some T star where you get a new behavior that's damped. And so, sorry to summarize, I'm a bit overdue, but so basically this isn't a real world material, but it's a different material, and it's strongly coupled and complicated, and it has effects that the other one doesn't have, and it doesn't have effects that the other one does have, but they both seem to show this rather similar behavior in terms of quenches. And what's interesting is that in our case, it's very easy to understand where that's coming from. It's really to do with symmetry breaking and sort of very generic things. Whereas if in the Barenkov-Levitov, it's naively very I'm sure they understand very well what's going on, but it's very difficult to understand where this difference in behavior comes from. And one question is whether there's some sort of more general way to understand all of this phenomena that doesn't really depend on any particular model. It's really just about patterns of symmetry breaking and sort of linear response around equilibrium solutions. Anyway, thank you. Sorry for going over time.